gun was just so tacky. I could have maybe understood it if the stones were flopping, like the rat leaving the sinking ship. But the fact is, the stones were doing very well, and all we had to do was keep it together. Instead of losing 4 or 5 years in the wilderness, and then having to pull it all together again. Everybody felt betrayed. What happened to the friendship? He couldn't have told me from the beginning that he was thinking of doing something else.
What really pissed me off at the time was Mick's compulsion to cultivate buddy relationships with CEOs, in this case Yetnikoff. Incessant telephone calls to impress them with his knowledge, letting them know that he was on top of it, when actually no one guy's on top of it. And annoying everyone with his constant interference in places where people who are paid fortunes to know how to do it better than he does. Our only strength was in distance, in a united front. That's how we did the Decca deal. We just stood there in shades and intimidated them into one of the best record deals of all time. My theory on working with record people is never to talk to them personally except on social occasions. You never get that close to them. You never get involved in the daily da-da-da. You pay somebody to do that. Asking about budgets for advertising and, hey, Walter, where's the... Making yourself personally available to the guy you're working with, you reduce yourself, diminish your power, you reduce the band. Because it's, Jagger's on the phone again. Oh, tell him to call me later. That's what happens. I like Walter very much, I think he's great. But Mick actually pulled the rug from under us by getting too familiar with him. There was a rare moment in late 1984 of Charlie throwing his drummer's punch. A punch I've seen a couple of times, and it's lethal. It carries a lot of balance and timing. He has to be badly provoked. He threw this one at Mick. We were in Amsterdam for a meeting. Mick and I weren't on great terms at the time, but I said, come on, let's go out. And I lent him the jacket I got married in. We got back to the hotel about 5 in the morning and Mick called up Charlie. I said, don't call him, not at this hour. But he did, and said, where's my drummer? No answer. He puts the phone down. Mick and I were still sitting there, pretty pissed. Give Mick a couple of glasses, he's gone. When about 20 minutes later, there was a knock at the door. There was Charlie Watts. Savile Row suit, perfectly dressed, tie, shaved, the whole fucking bit. I could smell the cologne. I opened the door, and he didn't even look at me. He walked straight past me, got a hold of Mick, and said, never call me your drummer again. Then he hauled him up by the lapels of my jacket and gave him a right hook. Mick fell back onto a silver platter of smoked salmon on the table and began to slide towards the open window and the canal below it. And I was thinking, this is a good one. And then I realized it was my wedding jacket. And I grabbed hold of it and caught Mick just before he slid into the Amsterdam Canal. It took me 24 hours after that to talk Charlie down. I thought I'd done it when I took him up to his room, but 12 hours later he was saying, fuck it, I'm gonna go down and do it again. It takes a lot to wind that man up. Why did you stop him? My jacket, Charlie, that's why. By the time we gathered in Paris to record Dirty Work in 1985, the atmosphere was bad. The sessions had been delayed because Mick was working on his solo album, and now he was busy promoting it. Mick had come with barely any songs for us to work on. He'd used them up on his own record, and he was often just not there at the studio. So I began writing a lot more on my own for Dirty Work, different kinds of songs. The horrendous atmosphere in the studio affected everybody. Bill Wyman almost stopped turning up. Charlie flew back home. In retrospect, I see that the tracks were full of violence and menace. Had It With You, One Hit to the Body, Fight. We made a video of One Hit to the Body that more or less told the story. We nearly literally came to blows, over and above our acting duties. Fight gives some idea of brotherly love between the Glimmer Twins at this juncture. Gonna pulp you to a mess of bruises, 'cause that's what you're looking for. There's a hole where your nose used to be. Gonna kick you out of my door. Gotta get into a fight. Can't get out of it. Gotta get into a fight. And there was Had It With You. I love you, dirty fucker, sister and a brother, moaning in the moonlight, singing for your supper, 'cause I had it, I had it, I had it with you. I had it, I had it, I had it with you. It is such a sad thing to watch a good love die. I've had it up to here, babe. I've got to say goodbye. 'Cause I had it, I had it, I had it with you. And I had it, I had it, I had it with you. That was the kind of mood I was in. I wrote Had It With You in Ronnie's front room in Chiswick, right on the banks of the Thames. We were waiting to go back to Paris, but the weather was so dodgy that we were stranded until the Dover ferry started rolling again. Peter Cook and Bert were hanging about. There was no heating, and the only way to keep warm was to turn on the amps. I don't think I'd ever written a song before, apart from maybe All About You, in which I realized I was actually singing about Mick. Mick's album was called She's the Boss, which said it all. I've never listened to the entire thing all the way through. Who has? It's like Mein Kampf. Everybody had a copy, but nobody listened to it. As to its subsequent titles, carefully worded, Primitive Cool, Goddess in the Doorway, which it was irresistible not to rechristen Dog Shit in the Doorway, I rest my case. He says I have no manners and a bad mouth. He's even written a song on the subject. But this record deal of Mick's was bad manners beyond any verbal jibes. Just by the choice of material, it seemed to me he had really gone off the tracks. It was very sad. He wasn't prepared not to make an impact, and he was upset. But I can't imagine why he thought it would fly. This is where I felt Mick had lost touch with reality. No matter what Mick's doing or what his intentions are, I'm not sitting around festering, nurturing venom. My attention, anyway, was turned suddenly and forcibly in December 1985 to the shattering news that Ian Stewart had died. He died of a heart attack, aged 47. I was waiting for him that afternoon in Blake's Hotel off the Fulham Road. He was going to meet me after he'd seen his doctor. Around 3 in the morning, I got a call from Charlie. Are you still waiting for Stu? I said, yes. Well, he's not coming, was Charlie's way of breaking the news. The wake was held at his golf course at Leatherhead, Surrey. He'd have appreciated the joke that this was the only way he'd ever get us there. We played a tribute gig to Stu at the 100 Club, the first time we'd been on stage together in 4 years. Stu was the hardest hit I ever had, apart from my son dying. At first you're anesthetized. You go on as if he's still there. And he did remain there, turning up one way or another for a very long time. He still does. The things that go through your mind are the things that make you laugh, that keep you close, like his jutting jawed way of speaking. He looms still, as when I remember how he cracked over Jerry Lee Lewis. At the beginning, my love for the Killers playing diminished me in Stu's soul. Bloody Fairy pounding away comes to mind as a typical Stu response. Then, about 10 years later, Stu came to me one night and said, I must admit some redeeming factors in Jerry Lee Lewis. Out of the blue. And this between takes. Now that's looming. He never broached the subject of life and death except if somebody else croaked. The silly sod, asking for it. When we went up to Scotland for the first time, Stu pulled over and asked someone, Can you not tell me the way to the Odeon? Stu being a very proud Scotsman from Kent. Stu was a law unto himself, in his cardigans and polo shirts. When we had expanded into the mega stadiums and satellite televisions, thousands in the audience, he'd come on stage in his hush puppies, with his cup of coffee and his cheese sandwich, which he put on the piano while he played. I got really mad at him for leaving me, which is my normal reaction when a friend or somebody I love croaks, when they're not supposed to. He left many legacies. Chuck Lavelle, from Dry Branch, Georgia, who had been in the Allman Brothers, was a Stu protege and appointee. He first played keyboards on tour with us in 1982 and became a permanent fixture on all subsequent tours. By the time Stu died, Chuck had been working with the Stones for several years. If I croak, God forbid, said Stu, Lavelle's the man. Maybe when he said that, he knew he was ill. He also said, "Don't forget that Johnny Johnson is alive and well and still playing in St. Louis." And it was all in the same year. Maybe a doctor had told him, "You've got so long to go." Dirty Work came out in early 1986, and I badly wanted to tour with it. So, of course, did the other band members who wanted to work. But Mick sent us a letter saying he wouldn't tour. He wanted to get on with his solo career. Soon after the letter came, I read in one of the English tabloids of Mick saying, "The Rolling Stones are a millstone around my neck." He actually said it. Swallow that one, fucker. I had no doubt that some part of his mind was thinking that, but saying it was another thing. That's when World War III was declared. Unable to tour, I thought on Stu's remark about Johnny Johnson. Johnson was Chuck Berry's original piano player and, if Chuck was honest, the co-writer of many Chuck Berry hits. But Johnson wasn't playing much in St. Louis. Ever since Chuck had told him to hasten down the wind, more than a decade before this, he'd been a bus driver, ferrying old folks around, almost entirely forgotten. It wasn't just his partnership with Berry that distinguished Johnny Johnson. He was one of the best ever players of blues piano. When we were cutting Dirty Work in Paris, the drummer Steve Jordan came to hang out in the studio, and then played on the album, filling in for Charlie, who was having a wobble of his own, carried away for a time on various stupefiants, as the French have it. Steve was around 30 then, and a very gifted all-around musician and singer. He had come to Paris to record, getting some leave from his job playing in the David Letterman Show band. Before that, he had played with the Saturday Night Live band and toured with Belushi and Aykroyd in their Blues Brothers band. Charlie had picked him out as a drummer back in 1978 when he was playing on Saturday Night Live and remembered him. Aretha Franklin called up because she was making a movie called Jumpin' Jack Flash with Whoopi Goldberg, and she wanted me to produce her title track for it. I remembered Charlie Watts saying, "If you ever work outside of this frame, Steve Jordan's your man." And I thought, well, if I'm going to do Jumpin' Jack Flash with Aretha, I've got to put a band together. I've got to start again. I knew Steve anyway, so that's how we forged ourselves on Aretha's soundtrack, which was a great session. And in my mind, it was lodged that if I'm going to do anything else, it's with Steve. I inducted Chuck Berry as one of the first musicians in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1986. And it happened that the band that played behind Chuck and all the other musicians jamming with him that night was the David Letterman Band with Steve Jordan on drums. Next thing I knew, Taylor Hackford asked me to be musical director for a feature film he was making for Chuck Berry's 60th birthday, and suddenly Stu's words were echoing. Johnny Johnson is alive. The first problem, I realized the minute I thought about it, was that Chuck Berry had been playing with pickup bands for so long, he'd forgotten what it was like to play with top hands. And especially with Johnny Johnson, who he'd not played with since they broke up in the early 1970s. When Chuck turned around and said, in his inimitable fashion, "Johnny, fuck off," he cut off a hand and a half. He thought he'd have hits forever. Was he too suffering from LVS, even though he played guitar? In fact, he never had a hit record after he split that band up, apart from his biggest record ever, My Ding-a-Ling. Go, Chuck. With Johnny Johnson, he had had the perfect unit. It was made in heaven, for Christ's sake. "Oh, no," says Chuck. "It's only me that counts. I can find another pianist, and anyway, I can get them cheaper, too." It's basically the cheapness he was concerned about. When I went with Taylor Hackford to see Chuck at his home in Wentzville, just outside St. Louis, I waited until the second day to slide the question. They're all talking about lighting, and I just said to Chuck, "I don't know if this is a good question, because I don't know your relationship. But is Johnny Johnson still about?" And he said, "I think he's in town." "But more importantly," said I, "could you two play together?" "Yeah," he said. "Shit yeah." A tense moment. Suddenly I've put Johnny Johnson back together with Chuck Berry. The possibilities are endless. Chuck rolled right in there, and it was a good decision, because he got a great movie out of it and a great band. One of those fabulous ironies now took place, and the joke was on me. I'd wanted Charlie to play the drums. Steve Jordan had wanted to do it, but I thought he wouldn't know the music well enough, and I was wrong there. But then I still didn't know him that well. So I told Steve, "Thanks, mate, but Charlie's up for it." Then on another visit, Chuck wanted to play me something quite urgently. He put on a video of the jam at the end of Chuck's induction into the Hall of Fame, and there was Steve whacking away on the drums, though the camera angle cut his head off. But it's rockin', and Chuck says, "Man, I like that drummer. Who's that drummer? I want that drummer on the film." So I had to call up Steve and say, "There may be an opening." No doubt Steve enjoyed that, but there was a kicker. He'd better tell it. Steve Jordan. Chuck flies down to meet us in Jamaica and stay at the house in Ocho Rios. And we go to pick Chuck up at the airport. It's a hot day, it's like 90 plus, very hot. And everybody's coming off the plane in shorts or bikinis because they know they're coming into sweltering weather. Chuck gets off the plane with a blazer, polyester flares, and a briefcase. It was hysterical. Then we're sitting around in the living room, and the drums are set up, and we're supposed to play together. We've just a couple of little champ amps and a couple of guitars, so we start banging out some stuff, and Chuck says, "So where's the drummer?" And I had dreadlocks. I'm looking like Sly Dunbar. And Keith says, "Well, this is the drummer. It's Steve. He's the drummer." And Chuck goes, "He's my drummer?" He looked at my dreadlocks and goes, "He ain't my drummer." Because there was no shot of my head in the video he'd seen, and he didn't know I had dreadlocks at the time. He was thinking I was some reggae drummer, and he didn't want to play with me. Then we started playing, and he was fine. I asked Johnny Johnson, "How did Sweet Little 16 and Little Queenie get written?" And he said, "Well, Chuck would have all these words, and we'd sort of play a blues format, and I would lay out the sequence." I said, "Johnny, that's called songwriting. And you should have had at least 50%. I mean, you could have cut a deal and taken 40, but you wrote those songs with him." He said, "I never thought about it that way. I just sort of did what I knew." Steve and I did the forensics on it, and we realized that everything Chuck wrote was in E-flat or C-sharp. Piano keys, not guitar keys. That was a dead giveaway. These are not great keys for guitar. Obviously, most of these songs started off on piano, and Chuck joined in, playing on the bar with his huge hands stretching across the strings. I got the sense that he followed Johnny Johnson's left hand. Chuck's hands are big enough. He's got the stretch for all that bar chord playing. Very long, slender hands. It took me a couple of years to figure out how it was possible to sound like that with smaller hands. It was by going to see Jazz on a Summer's Day, where Chuck plays Sweet Little 16. I watched his hands, where they were moving, where the fingers were going, and discovered that if I transposed this into guitar keys, something with a root note, I could get my own swing on it, just the way Chuck did. And the beautiful thing about Chuck Berry's playing was it had such an effortless swing. None of this sweating and grinding away and grimacing, just pure, effortless swing like a lion. It was fantastic, to say the least, to put Chuck and Johnny together. What was interesting was the way they reacted off each other. They hadn't done it together for so long. Just by being there, Johnny reminded Chuck of how it really went, and Chuck had to come up to Johnny's mark. He'd been playing with slouches for years, with the cheapest band in town, just going in and out with a briefcase. To a musician, playing below your mark is soul-destroying, and he had been doing that for ages, to the point where he was completely cynical about the music. When Johnny was rocking, Chuck would say, "Hey, remember this one?" and switch to something really out of left field. It was weird and funny to watch Chuck catching up to Johnny, and also with the band, because now he's got Steve Jordan on drums, and he ain't played with a drummer like that since goddamn 58. I put a band together that came to find Chuck Berry as much as that was possible, to present him with a band that was as good as his original. And I think we did it in our own way, although he's an elusive motherfucker. But I'm used to working with elusive motherfuckers. One really brilliant thing that came out of that movie. I gave Johnny Johnson a new life. He got a chance to play in front of people on a good piano. And for the rest of his life, he was playing all over the world and being liked. He had gigs, he was recognized. And more important than anything else, he had self-respect again. And he was seen for what he was, a brilliant player. He never thought anybody knew it was him on all those incredible records. His credits and royalties as a composer eluded him. Maybe it wasn't Chuck's fault. Maybe it was Chess Records. It wouldn't have been the first time. Johnny never asked, so it was never given to him. Johnny Johnson had another 15 years of being heard, doing what he should have been doing, and getting his kudos, not croaking behind a wheel. I don't knock people much outside my intimate circle, but I've got to say, Chuck Berry was a big disappointment. He was my numero uno hero. Shit, I thought. The cat's got to be great to play like that, write like that, sing like that, sling the hash like that. He's got to be a great cat. When he put his equipment together with ours for the film, I found out later that he charged the production company for the use of his amps. From the first bar of that first night of the show at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, Chuck threw all our carefully laid plans to the wind, playing totally different arrangements in different keys. It didn't really matter. It was the best Chuck Berry live you're ever going to get. As I said when I inducted him into the Hall of Fame, I've stolen every lick he ever played. So I owed it to Chuck to bite the bullet when he was at his most provocative, to play rope-a-dope to see it through. And he sure pushed me hard. You can see it in the film. It's very difficult for me to allow myself to be bullied. And that is what Chuck was doing to me and everyone else. Yet what I think about Chuck deep down is what I wrote in a fax to him one day after hearing him on the radio for the millionth time. Dear Mr. Berry, let me say that despite our ups and downs, I love you so. Your work is so precious and beautifully timeless. I'm still in awe. I'm hoping they don't make another like you. I couldn't take the heat. You may feel the same way about me. My love to you, brother, for what it's worth. Keith Richards, 05. P.S. Your English is better than mine. The big betrayal by Mick, which I find hard to forgive, a move that seemed almost deliberately designed to close down the Rolling Stones, was his announcement in March 1987, that he would go on tour with his second solo album, Primitive Cool. I had been assuming we would tour in 1986 and was already frustrated by Mick's delaying tactics. And now it all came clear. As Charlie put it, he'd folded up 25 years of the Rolling Stones. That's what it looked like. The Stones didn't tour at all from 1982 to 1989, and didn't go into the studio together from 85 to 89. Said Mick, "The Rolling Stones cannot be, at my age and after spending all these years, the only thing in my life. I certainly have earned the right to express myself in another way." And he did. The way he expressed himself was to go on tour with another band singing Rolling Stones songs. I really believe that Mick wouldn't dare tour without the Stones. It was too hard a slap in the face to deliver to us. It was a death sentence, pending appeal. And for what? But I was wrong, and I was outraged and hurt. Mick was touring. So I let him have it, mostly in the press. An opening shot was, if he doesn't want to go out with the Stones, and then goes out with Schmuck and Ball's band instead, I'll slit his fucking throat. And Mick responded loftily, "I love Keith. I admire him. But I don't feel we can really work together anymore. I can't recall all the jibes and barbs I let loose. Disco Boy, Jagger's little jerk-off band, why didn't he join Aerosmith? That's the kind of stuff I fed the grateful tabloids. It got really bad. One day a reporter asked me, 'When are you two going to stop bitching at each other?' 'Ask the bitch,' I replied. Then I thought, let the guy have his play. I took it like that. Let him go out there and fall flat on his face. He'd shown a total lack of friendship, of camaraderie, of everything that's necessary to hold a band together. He was a dump. Charlie felt even worse about it than I did, I think. I saw a clip of Mick's show, and he had Keith look-alike guitar players, stepping in tandem, doing Guitar Hero moves. When it was on the road, I was asked what I thought, and I said it was sad that a high percentage of his show was Rolling Stones songs. I said, if you're going to do something on your own, do stuff off the two albums you did. Don't pretend you're a solo artist and have two chicks prancing around doing tumbling dice. The Rolling Stones spent a lot of time building up integrity, as much as you can get in the music industry. And the way Mick handled his solo career jeopardized all that. And it severely pissed me off. Mick had misjudged something by 100 miles. He took it for granted that any bunch of good musicians would be as compatible with him as the Rolling Stones. But he didn't sound like himself. He had great players, but it's kind of like the World Cup. England's not Chelsea or Arsenal. It's a different game. And you've got to work with a different team. Now you've hired the best bands around, and you've got to form a relationship with them, which is not Mick's forte. He could certainly strut around and have the star on his dressing room door and treat the band like hirelings. But you can't get good music that way. After that, I decided, fuck it. I want a band. I was determined to make music in Mick's absence. I wrote a lot of songs. I began to sing in a new way on songs like Sleep Tonight. It was a deeper sound, one I'd never had before. And it worked well for the kind of ballads I had started writing. So I called in guys I'd always wanted to work with, and I knew the man to start with. You could almost say a collaboration had begun between me and Steve Jordan even back in Paris, during the making of Dirty Work. Steve encouraged me. He heard something in my voice that he thought could make records. If I had a melody I was working on, I'd get him to sing it, and I thrive on collaboration. I need a reaction to think anything I've done is any good. So back in New York, we started to hang, and we wrote a lot of songs together. Then with his buddy and collaborator Charlie Drayton, mainly a bass player, but also another superbly gifted drummer, we started to jam at Woody's house. Then Steve and I hung in Jamaica for a while, and he became my buddy. And Steve and I found, hey, we can write too. He's the only one. It's either going to be Jagger Richards or Jordan Richards. Steve will tell how we came together. Steve Jordan. Keith and I were very close during those times when we were writing, before we put together a band, when there was just the two of us. We went into a studio called Studio 900, which was right around the corner from where I lived and up the street from where he lived in New York. And we would go in there and hunker down. The first time we went in there, we played 12 hours straight. Keith didn't even go out and take a piss. It was unbelievable. It was just sheer love of music that bound us. But it was clearly liberating for him. He had so many ideas he wanted to get out. And certainly he was upset, or at least, when it came to writing, wearing his heart on his sleeve. Much of the music was very specific. It was about his old partner. You Don't Move Me was a classic of its kind, which ended up on the first solo album, Talk Is Cheap. All I had was the title, You Don't Move Me Anymore, and I had no idea which way to shift it. I could be a guy talking to a chick or a chick talking to a guy, but then, when I got the first verse, I realized where my mind was going. I suddenly had a focus, and it was Mick, trying to be gracious at the same time, but my version of graciousness. What makes you so greedy makes you so seedy. Steve and I thought we ought to make a record and started to put together the core of the expensive winos. So named later on when I noticed a bottle of Chateau Lafite introduced as light refreshment in the studio. Well, nothing was too good for this amazing band of brothers. Steve asked me who I wanted to play with, and first up, on guitar, I said, Waddy Wachtel. And Steve said, you took the words, brother. I had known Waddy since the 70s, and I'd always wanted to play with him. One of the most tasteful, simpatico players I know. And he's completely musical. Understanding of it, empathetic, nothing ever needing to be explained. He's also got the most uncanny, ultrasonic ear, still tuned high after years of bandstands. He was playing with Linda Ronstadt, and he was playing with Stevie Nicks, chick bands. But I knew my man wanted to rock. So I called him and said simply, "I'm putting a band together, and you're in it." Steve agreed that Charlie Drayton should be the bass player. And I think it was just a general consensus that Ivan Neville, from Aaron Neville's family from New Orleans, should be the piano player. There was no audition process whatsoever. The Winos were put together very slyly. Almost everybody in that band can play anything. They can switch instruments, they can virtually all sing. Steve can sing. Ivan's a fantastic singer. This core band, from the first few bars we ever played, took off like a rocket. I've always been incredibly lucky with guys I've played with. And there's no way you can stand in front of the Winos without getting off. It's a surefire high. It was so hot you could hardly believe it. It brought me back to life. I felt as if I'd just gotten out of jail. As engineer, we had Don Smith, who Steve had picked out. He had cut his teeth at Stax in Memphis and worked with Don Nix, who wrote Going Down. He also worked with Johnny Taylor, one of my earliest heroes. He'd hung out in the juke joints of Memphis with Furry Lewis. He loved his music. Waddy describes our journey and bears flattering witness to my improvement as a singer from the early thwarted promise of the Dartford boy soprano. Waddy Wachtel. We went up to Canada and did the whole first record, Talk Is Cheap, there. I think the second track we cut was Take It So Hard, which is a magnificent composition. And I just thought, I get to play on this? Let's go. And we played it a few times. I guess you could call it rehearsing. And there's one take that is just a great pass. It's just ridiculously good. It was the second tune of the night, and it was this killer fucking take of our strongest tune. I went back to the house going, we've conquered Everest already? These other mountains we can climb easily if we've got the big one down. And Keith didn't want to believe it. He was going, I don't want these guys thinking that they're good. He made us do a retake. I don't know why. The take was shouting, hey dude, I'm the take. I think Keith just did it to make sure people stayed in focus. But it never sounded as good as that first take. When you've got it, you've got it. When we were putting the sequence of the album together, I insisted Big Enough should be the first song. Because the first time you hear Keith sing on that, that first line is amazing. His voice sounds so beautiful. He delivers it effortlessly. I said, people, when they hear this, they're not going to believe it's fucking Keith Richards singing. And then we'll hit him with Take It So Hard. In fact, on Talk Is Cheap, it's not just our band. We looked high and low. We went down to Memphis and recruited Willie Mitchell and put the Memphis horns on Make No Mistake. Willie Mitchell. He engineered, arranged, produced, and wrote all the Al Green stuff, either with Al Green or with Al Jackson or both. So we went down to the studio where he did all Al Green's records, and we had him do a horn arrangement. We tried for everybody we wanted, and we got most of them. We had Maceo Parker playing, we had Mick Taylor, William Bootsy Collins, Joey Stompanato, Chuck Lavelle, Johnny Johnson, Bernie Worrell, Stanley Buckwheat Durrell, Bobby Keys, Sarah Dash. And we had Baby Floyd singing with us on tour. Great singer, great voice, one of the best. Baby Floyd used to do Pain in My Heart on our tour and do the whole Otis bit, getting down on his knees. On the last night of the Winos tour, we shackled him by his ankle to the microphone stand because we thought he was a little overdoing it. How do you shackle him without him knowing it? It's done very carefully. I'd never really ridden with anybody on a long-term basis except Mick, and I wasn't really riding much with Mick anymore. We were writing our own songs, and I didn't realize until I worked with Steve Jordan how much I'd missed that and how important it was to collaborate. When the band was assembled in the studio, I often composed the songs there, just standing up and vowling, hollering, whatever it took, a process that was unfamiliar to Waddy at first. Waddy Wachtel. It was very funny. Keith's concept of writing was this. Set up some mics. Huh? Okay. He goes, okay, let's go sing it. Go sing what? And he goes, go sing it. What are you talking about? Go sing what? We don't have anything. And he goes, yeah, right. Let's go make something up. And this is it. This is the routine. So Steve and I are standing up there with him. And every so often he'd go, what the fuck? That feels good. Trying to come up with lines. Throw everything at the wall, see if it sticks. And that was basically the routine. It was amazing. And we got some lines out of it, too. I did start writing as well as singing songs differently. For one thing, I wasn't writing for Mick. Songs that he'd have to deliver on stage. But mostly, I was learning to sing. First off, I put the songs in a lower key, which allowed me to get my voice down from the high-pitched songs like Happy. The melodies, too, were different from the Stones' melodies. And I was learning to sing into the microphone, rather than waving in and out while I played air guitar, which I used to do while I sang on stage. Don Smith rigged the mics and compressors so that I heard it very loud in the headphones, which meant I couldn't sing loud and scream, which used to be the way I'd do it. I got writing quieter songs, ballads, love songs, songs from the heart. We went on tour. Suddenly I was the front man. Okay. We're going to do this. It made me far more sympathetic to some of Mick's more loony things. When you have to sing every goddamn song, you have to develop your lungs. You're doing an hour-odd show every day, not only singing, but prancing around and playing guitar. And that brought my voice on. Some people hate it. Some people love it. It's a voice with character. Pavarotti it ain't. But then, I don't like Pavarotti's voice. When you sing lead in a band, it's an exhausting business. Just the breathing involved. Singing song after song is enough to knock most people on their ass. It's an incredible amount of oxygen you're going through. So we would do shows and we'd come off stage and I'd go to bed. Sometimes, of course, we'd be up till the next show. But a lot of times, it would be forget it. We had the time of our lives, touring with the Winos. We had standing ovations at almost every show. We did small theaters, sellouts. We broke even. The caliber of musicianship across the stage was astonishing. Fabulous playing every night. The music flowing like crazy. We were flying. It was really magic. In the end, neither Mick nor I sold a lot of records from our solo albums. Because they want the rolling, bleeding Stones, right? At least I got two great rock and roll records out of it, and credibility. But Mick went out there trying to be a pop star on his own. He got out there and hung his flag and had to pull it down. I'm not gloating about what happened, but it didn't surprise me. In the long run, he had to come back to the Stones to re-identify himself, for redemption. So here come the Millstones, brother, to save you from drowning. I was not going to put the first feeler out. I was over it. I was not interested in being with the Stones under these conditions. By then I had a very good record under my belt and I was enjoying myself. I would have done another Winos record right then. There was a phone call. There was some shuttle diplomacy. The meeting that followed wasn't easy to organize. Blood had been spilt. Neutral territory had to be found. Mick wouldn't come to Jamaica where I was. This is now early January 1989. I wouldn't go to Mystique. Barbados was the choice. Eddie Grant's Blue Wave Studios were down the road. The first thing we did was to say, this has got to stop. I'm not using the Daily Mirror as my mouthpiece. They're loving this. They're eating us alive. It was a little sparring, but then we started laughing about the things we'd called each other in the press. That was probably the healing moment. I called you a what? We hit it off. Mick and I may not be friends. Too much wear and tear for that. But we're the closest of brothers. And that can't be severed. How can you describe a relationship that goes that far back? Best friends are best friends, but brothers fight. I felt a real sense of betrayal. Mick knows how I feel, although he may not have realized my feelings went so deep. But it's the past I'm writing about. This stuff happened a long time ago. I can say these things. They come from the heart. At the same time, nobody else can say anything against Mick that I can hear. I'll slit their throat. Whatever has happened, Mick and I have a relationship that still works. How else, after almost 50 years, could we still be contemplating, at the time of writing this, going out on the road again together? Even if our dressing rooms do have to be a mile distant for practical reasons, he can't stand my sounds, and I can't listen to him practicing scales for an hour. We love what we do. When we meet up again, whatever antagonisms have been whipped up in the meantime, we drop them and start talking about the future. We always come up with something when we're alone together. There's an electromagnetic spark between us. There always has been. That's what we look forward to, and that's what helps turn folks on. That's what happened at that meeting in Barbados. It was the beginning of the detent of the 80s. I let water go under the bridge. I may be unforgiving, but I can't work a grudge that long. As long as we got something going, everything else becomes peripheral. We're a band. We know each other. We better refigure this. Refigure our relationship with each other. Because the Stones are bigger than any of us when it comes down to the nitty-gritty. Can you and I get together and make some good music? That's our thing. The key, as ever, was to have no one else there. There is a marked difference between me and Mick alone, and me and Mick when there's somebody else. Anybody else in the room. It could just be the housemaid, the chef, anybody. It becomes totally different. When we're alone, we talk about what's happening. Oh, the old ladies kick me out of the house. A phrase will come up and we start working on that phrase. It very quickly falls into piano, guitar, songs, and the magic returns. I pull things out of him. He pulls things out of me. He can do things in a way that you wouldn't think of. You wouldn't plan. They just happen. Pretty soon everything was forgotten. Less than 2 weeks after that first meeting, we were recording our first album in 5 years, Steel Wheels, at Air Studios in Montserrat, with Chris Kimsey back as co-producer. And the Steel Wheels tour, the biggest circus yet, was planned to start in August 1989. Having nearly dissolved the Stones forever, Mick and I were now faced with a further 20 years on the road. I knew that this was about starting over again. Either this thing was going to break and all the wheels would fall off, or we'd survive. Everybody else had swallowed the pill and got over it. We wouldn't have been able to start it up otherwise. So it was kind of amnesia of the immediate past, although the bruises still showed. We prepared with care. We rehearsed for 2 solid months. It was a massive new operation. The set, designed by Mark Fisher, was the biggest stage ever constructed. 2 stages would leapfrog each other along the route. The trucks carrying a movable village with spaces for everything from rehearsal rooms to the pool table where Ronnie and I warmed up before shows. No longer a pirate nation on the road. This was the changeover in both personality and style, from Bill Graham to Michael Cole, who'd been a promoter for us in Canada. This time I realized how big a spectacle I was involved in. Huge. Enormous. A new kind of deal. The Stones only started to make money through touring in the 80s. The tour of 81-82 was the start of the big stadium venues and broke box office records for rock shows. Bill Graham was the promoter. He was the king of rock concerts at the time, a big backer of the counterculture, of unknown artists and good causes, as well as bands like the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. But that last tour was a rather dodgy period. A lot of bits were going missing. The mathematics weren't adding up. To put it more simply, we needed to get control of our shows again. Rupert Lowenstein had reordered the finances so that basically, we didn't get cheated out of 80% of the takings, which was nice. On a $50 ticket up till then, we'd get $3. He'd set up sponsorship and clawed back merchandising deals. He cleaned out the scams and fiddles, or most of them. He made us viable. I loved Bill dearly. He was a wonderful guy. But his head was beginning to turn. He was getting too big for his boots, as they all do when they've been doing it for too long. Separate from Bill, his business partners were stealing money from us and openly bragging about it. One of them telling how he bought a house with it.
The inside machinations are nothing to do with me. Eventually I'm going to end up on stage playing. That's why I pay other people. The whole point is that I can only do what I do if I have the space to do it in. That's why you work with people like Bill Graham or Michael Cole or whoever. They take this weight off your shoulders. But you're going to get a good cut of it. All I've got to do is have somebody on my staff like Rupert or Jane who makes sure, at the end of the day, that the right shekels end up in the right pot. There was a big meeting on one of the islands when we threw in our lot with Michael Cole, and he then did all our tours up to a bigger bang in 2006. Mick does have a talent for discovering good people, but they can get discarded or left lying about. Mick finds them, Keith keeps them, is the motto in our troupe, and it's borne out by the facts. There were two people particularly that Mick had picked up for his solo stuff, and without knowing it, he actually put me in contact with some of the best. Guys I wouldn't let go of again or ever. Pierre de Beauport, who came to Barbados as Mick's sole assistant when Mick and I met up again, was one. He had taken a summer job out of college to learn to make records in New York, and Mick brought him along on his solo tour. Pierre can not only mend anything from tennis rackets to fishing nets, he's a genius at guitars and amplifiers. When I came to Barbados, all I'd brought with me was one old Fender Tweed amp, which was barely working and sounded terrible. Pierre, of course, as a rookie working for Mick, had been warned never to cross the Cold War battle lines, as if it was North and South Korea, when all it was East and West Berlin. One day, Pierre, cutting through all that, got hold of the Tweedy, stripped it, reassembled it, and made it work perfectly. He got a hug from me. It wasn't very long before I knew that he's the man, because also, and he hid it for a long time, he can play guitar like a motherfucker. He can play this shit better than I can. We fell in through our total infatuation with, an obsessive love of, the guitar. After that, he was backstage for me, handing me the guitars. He's the guitar curator and trainer. But we're a team music-wise, too, to the point where now, if I think I've got a good song, I'll play it to Pierre before I'll play it to anybody else. All these guitars Pierre presides over have nicknames and personalities. He knows their different sounds and properties. Most of the people who made them in 54, 55, 56 are dead and gone. If they were 40 or 50 years old then, they would now be well over 100. But you can still read the names of the checkers, the ones who gave them the seal of approval inside the guitars. So the guitars get their nicknames from their checkers. On Satisfaction, I play a lot of Malcolm, a Telecaster. While on Jumpin' Jack Flash, I play Dwight, another Telecaster. Micawber is a real all-rounder. Micawber's got a lot of highs. Malcolm's got more bottom on it. And Dwight's an in-betweener. I take my hat off to Pierre and the rest of his backline crew. On stage, things go wrong suddenly. They have to be prepared for a guitar with a broken string to come back for a restring and have one ready that's going to sound similar and fling it over the guy's neck in 10 seconds. In the old days, fuck it. If you broke your guitar, you just walked off and let everybody else carry on until you'd sorted it yourself. With all this film and video, everything is under scrutiny. Ronnie's a string breaker. Mick is actually the worst. When he plays guitar, he thrashes the thing with his pick. The second new arrival was Bernard Fowler, singer with the band ever since, along with Lisa Fisher and Blondie Chaplin, who came a few years later. Bernard, too, was working with Mick on his solo stuff. Bernard has since sung on my solo records and on every song I've written since he arrived on the scene. The first thing I said to Bernard when he was doing some backup vocals in the studio was, "You know, I didn't want to like you." "Why not?" "You're one of his guys." Bernard cracked up and the ice was broken. I felt I stole him in a way from Mick. But I wanted to get out of this embattled idea anyway, and we sing good together. So all that shit went out of the way. I smuggled Bobby Keys back into the band in 1989 for the Steel Wheels tour, but it wasn't easy.
He'd been out for 10 years or so, apart from some one-night gigs. It took me that long to get him back in. And when I did, I didn't tell anyone at first. We were rehearsing for the new tour at the Nassau Coliseum. We were getting to the dress rehearsals, and I wasn't too happy with the horns. So I rang Bobby and said, "Get on a plane and hide yourself when you get here." So we're going to play Brown Sugar, and Bobby was in. But Mick didn't know he was there. I just told Bobby, when we play Brown Sugar, come in on the solo. So it was solo time, and Mick looked round at me and said, "What the fuck?" I just said, "See what I mean?" And when it was over, Mick looked at me like, well, you can't argue with that. I mean, baby, that is rock and roll. But it took me years to grease Bobby back into the band. As I said, some of my friends can really fuck up, but so can I, and so can Mick, so can anybody. If you can't fuck up, where's your halo? My life is full of broken halos. Mick didn't speak one word to Bobby for the whole tour, but he stayed. I added one more member to the Richards gang in the person of Steve Crotty, one of those people who just find me, who become instant friends. Steve comes from Preston, Lancashire. His dad was a butcher and a rough man, which is why Steve left home at 15 for a life of pretty rough adventure. I met Steve in Antigua, where he ran a famous restaurant, a big hangout for musicians and yachtsmen called Pizzas in Paradise. Anyone recording at George Martin's Air Studios in Montserrat would come back to Antigua. So Steve knew many people in the business. We used to stay at Nelson's Dockyard, which was not far from his restaurant. I struck up immediately with Steve, recognizing a kindred spirit, a jailbird, of course. My mates go to the most distinguished jails. In Steve's case, he'd recently been released from the prison outside Sydney, Australia, in Botany Bay, where Captain Cook landed. He was there sentenced to hard labor for 8 years, of which he did 3.5, locked up 23 hours a day. Part of the reason Steve survived its brutalities untouched was that it was known he had kept his mouth shut and taken the rap for 2 friends who got away. That's the kind of bloke he is. For such a sweet-natured man, hard though he is, Steve's taken a lot of beatings. One day, Spanish sailors cracked out of their heads came into his bar at 3 a.m., and he told them he was closing. They nearly killed him. He was in a coma for some days, suffered aneurysms, lost 9 teeth, couldn't see for 2 weeks. Why had they beat him so badly? The last bit of dialogue exchanged was Steve saying, "Come back later today and I'll buy you a drink." He turns to the bar and hears, "I fuck your mother." So Steve says, "Well, somebody did. What do you want me to do, call you daddy?" He suffered for that. When Steve had recovered, I asked him to come and look after my place in Jamaica, where he is today as sheriff of the Caribbean Conference. While this book was being written, a guy came armed with a pistol to rob my house there. Steve floored him with an electric guitar. The guy's elbow hit the floor, and his gun went off. The bullet went in an inch from Steve's willy, missed all the major arteries, and went out. What you call a clean shot. The guy that broke in was shot dead by the police. There was one time the blade was called for while we were rehearsing in Montserrat. We were recording a song called Mixed Emotions. One of our engineers was there and witnessed it, and he had better tell it. I don't include it just to brag about how accurate I am with a throwing knife, although it's lucky I made my mark on this occasion, but to show the kind of thing that triggers the red mist. In this case, someone coming into the studio who didn't play an instrument, who knew fuck all about what I was doing, and tried to tell me how to improve the track. Yap, yap, yap. As this eyewitness remembered. Some bigwig figure in the music business, invited by Mick, came to Montserrat to discuss some contract to do with touring. He obviously fancied himself for his producing abilities, because we're standing in the studio area playing back Mixed Emotions, which was going to be the first single, and Keith is standing there with his guitar on, and Mick's standing there, and we're listening to it. The song finishes, and the guy says, "Keith, great song, man, but I tell you, I think if you arranged it a little bit differently, it would be so much better. So Keith went to his doctor's bag and pulled out a knife and threw it, and it landed right between the bloke's legs. Boing! It was really like William Tell. It was great. Keith says, "Listen, sonny, I was writing songs before you were a glint on your father's dick. Don't you tell me how to write songs." And he walked out. And then Mick had to smooth it over, but it was fantastic. I'll never forget. The Great Steel Wheels tour was all set to go when I got a visit from Rupert Lowenstein. Not from Mick, who should have come himself. To say that Mick would not do the tour if Jane Rose was on it. Jane Rose was and still is, as I write, my manager. Last heard of heroically sticking by me during my last cleanup in the days after the Toronto bust in 1977. And all through the months, years, of the court cases in Canada that followed. She is an unseen presence in much of the narrative since then. We were in the summer of 1989, 10 years after those events, and Jane had certainly become a thorn in Mick's side. Though he put the thorn there himself. Jane had worked jointly for Mick and me for what now seems like an impossibly long time. From that Toronto period up to 1983, though for a while her working for me was unofficial. She was delegated by Mick to stick by me and help me out. In 1983, Mick decided he wanted to get rid of her and dismissed her from the Rolling Stones. He didn't tell me. And when I found out, I wouldn't have it. Not me, pal. I'm not going to throw off Jane Rose. I believed in her. She stayed with me in Toronto. She went through all this stuff with me. And also, she'd been acting as my manager. I rehired her that same day. Jane immediately became a force to be reckoned with. When Mick had refused to tour in 1986, Jane started setting up projects for me. First an ABC television special with Jerry Lee Lewis. Then Jumpin' Jack Flash with Aretha Franklin. Then a record deal with Virgin, which had newly arrived in the United States, to make the Winos record. It was me and Jane was driven. So now Mick wanted to insist that she couldn't come on the tour. It was the same old problem. Someone getting too close to me, making it difficult to control me. And now someone who kept thwarting Mick's plans for controlling the whole shebang. Jane is tenacious. She's my bulldog. She just will not let go. And she usually wins it. In this case, she was fighting simply to have me consulted on important stuff, which Mick was always avoiding. So she flew directly in the face of Mick's desire to command. Worse for her in this situation. And she's had a doubly hard task because of it. She's a chick. But Jane did some major things for me. From the Winos deal to my appearance in Pirates of the Caribbean, which she pulled off by sheer tenacity. After she'd done the deal with Virgin for me, Rupert asked her if she thought the Stones might switch to the label, and in 1991, we signed an enormous deal with them. Jane can be annoying at times, bless her heart, and she's inflicted bruises. Often people bump into her expecting her to give way and find a rock in their path. I have a tiger in disguise here, and a devoted one. When Mick gave his ultimatum to ban her back in the mid-80s, he had been incensed by my slipping Bobby Keys back into the lineup, defying his ban on Bobby, used as he was to running everything. Maybe this was his way of getting back at me, but my response to his ultimatum was predictable. If you won't tour with Jane Rose, no tour. So the tour went ahead with Jane on it. And in some ways, I don't think Mick got over it. But he chose his ground badly. There are comic sides to all this. One of which was Mick's pathological inability to consult me before executing his great ideas. Mick always thought he needed more and more props and effects, piling on the gimmicks. The inflatable cock was great. But because a couple of things worked, every tour we started, I'd have to send acts home. I think you're better off without any props, or the minimum. Many times, I cut down the prop projects on these tours. He wanted stilt walkers. Luckily, at dress rehearsals it was raining, and all the stilt walkers fell over. I had to fire 35 dancers who were going to appear for about 30 seconds on honky-tonk women. Sight unseen, I sent them all home. Sorry, girls, go hoof it somewhere else. That was $100,000 down the sink. Nick had got used to the fait accompli in the 70s, believing I wouldn't notice his decisions. I almost always did, even then, especially when it came to music. My weary faxes would go like this. Mick, how is it that the Stones tracks are being mixed and about to be issued without a by your leave? I find this odd, to say the least. Terrible mixes anyway. If you don't know that by now, this is thrown at me as a fait accompli. How could you be so clumsy? Who chose the tracks? Who chose the mixing? Why do you imagine that it's your decision? Will you never realize that you cannot piss around with me? It wasn't Mick any more than the rest of us who conceived these mega tours. Steel Wheels, Voodoo Lounge, Bridges to Babylon, 40 Licks, A Bigger Bang. These great traveling shows that kept us on the road for many months at a time from 1989 to 2006. It was basically public demand that expanded them to this size. People say, why do you keep doing this? How much money do you need? Well, everyone likes making money, but we just wanted to do shows. And we're working in an unknown medium. He felt drawn to it like a moth to a flame because it was there and they wanted it. And what can you say? That must be right. You've asked for it. You got it. I prefer theaters. But where are you going to put everybody? We never realized just what the scale of this thing would become. How did it get so big? When we're not doing anything much different than what we did in 1963 in the Crawdaddy Club. Our usual set is 2/3 standard Stones numbers, the classics. The only thing that's different is the audiences have grown, and the show's gotten longer. All any top act would do is 20 minutes when we started. The Everly Brothers did maybe half an hour. When you're talking about a tour, you're talking cold-blooded arithmetic. It's how many bums on seats. How much does it cost to put the show on? It's an equation. You could say that Michael Cole was the one who expanded things to this scale. But he did it by judging the demand. After 8 years without a tour and taking a risk. We hadn't known for sure whether the demand was still that high, though it was clear Cole had got it right when tickets went on sale that first day in Philadelphia and could have sold out 3 times. Touring was the only way to survive. Record royalties barely paid overheads. You couldn't tour behind a record like the old days. Mega tours were, in the end, the bread and butter of keeping this machinery running. We couldn't have done it on a smaller scale and been sure to do more than break even. The Stones were a rarity in this market, in that the show that filled the stadium was still based on the music, nothing else. You're not going to see dance routines or get a tape playing. You'll just hear the Stones and see them. There were aspects of these tours that would have been unthinkable in the 70s. There were shocked murmurings that we'd become a corporate enterprise and an advertising medium through all the sponsorship deals. But this, too, was part of the bread and butter, the equation. How do you finance a tour? And as long as it's a fair deal to the audience and to yourselves, that's the way they figure it out. There were the corporate meet-and-greet sessions, where people came in and shake our hands and get their pictures taken. That were part of our contract. In actual fact, it's fun. They're just loads of pissed people lined up going, "Hey, how you doing, baby? Oh, I love you. Hey, brother." It's pressing the flesh. These people work for these companies that sponsor us. It's also part of the build-up. Oh, we're actually starting to do the work. Finish the snooker game, meet and greet time, and in a way, it's reassuring. It means it's 2 hours before we go on. So you know where you are. Everybody likes a bit of routine, especially when you're in a new city every day. Our biggest problem with the huge stadiums and sets, the open-air venues, was the sound. How do you convert a stadium into a club? A perfect rock and roll theater would be a really large garage made of brick with a bar at the end. There is no such thing as a rock and roll venue. There's not one in the world that's made to play this kind of music as an ideal form. You work and wedge yourself into spots
that are made to do other things. What we love is a controlled environment. There are some theaters like the Astoria, really good ballrooms like Roseland in New York, the Paradiso in Amsterdam. There's a good Chicago joint called the Checkerboard. There's an optimum size and space. But when you're playing outdoors on those big stages, you never quite know what's in store for you. There's another guy that joins the band on outdoor stages. God. Either he's benign, or he can come at you with wind from the wrong direction and the sound is swept out of the park, and somebody is getting the best stone sound in the world, but they're 2 miles away and they don't want it. Luckily, I have the magic stick. Before the shows start, we come into a sound check, and I traditionally have one of my rods in my hand and make some Kabbalistic signs in the sky and on the floor of the stage. Okay, the weather's gonna be cool. It's a fetish, but if I come to an open-air gig without a stick, they think I'm ill. The weather usually comes around by showtime. Some of our best gigs have been in the worst conditions that you'd want to play in. In Bangalore, our first gig in India, their monsoon actually came down in the middle of the opening song and pissed down throughout the show. You couldn't see the fretboard for rain splashing and squirting all over the place. Monsoon in Bangalore. That's what we still call it. It was a famous show. But it was a great show. Sleet, snow, rain, or anything, the audience always stays there. If you stay there with them, under the worst conditions in the world, they'll stay there and rock and forget about the weather. The worst ones are when there's a cold snap. That's really hard to work when the fingers are freezing. There are very few of them. We try and avoid them. And Pierre will have guys backstage to give us little heat bags to put on for a few minutes until the next song starts, just to keep our fingers from freezing. There's a scar I have from burning my finger to the bone while playing the very first number one night. It was my fault. I told everybody, stand back. There's a big pyro to start with. And then I forgot. I went out there. The fireworks were going off. And a lump of white phosphorus settled on my finger. And it's steaming and burning. And I know I can't touch it. If I touch it, I'm going to spread it. I'm playing Start Me Up. And I just got to let my finger burn through to the bone. I'm watching my white bone for the next 2 hours. I remember a show in Italy where I really knew that I was losing it. It was in Milan in the 70s, and I could barely stand. I couldn't breathe. The air was totally dead. It was hot, and I started to feel myself going. Mick was just about holding himself up. Charlie always has some shade. But I was out in the pollution of Milan, the heat and the chemicals there and the brutal sun. There have been a couple of shows like that. Sometimes I've woken up with a temperature of 103. But I'm going to go on. I can handle it. I'll probably sweat it out on stage. And most times I do. I've had terrible fevers going on, and I'm totally cured at the end of the show, just because of the nature of the job. Sometimes I should have canceled the show and stayed in bed. But I think if I can totter up there, I will. And with a bit of sweating, I'll pull through. There are occasions when I've actually been sick on stage. How many times I've turned around behind the amplifiers and chucked up, you wouldn't believe. Mick pukes behind the stage. Ronnie pukes behind the stage, too. Sometimes it's the conditions, not enough air, too much heat. Throwing up is not such a big deal. It's in order to make you better. Where's Mick gone?